Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Sarah Chase. She's a former NPR reporter who lives and works in Afghanistan. She's author of the book, The Punishment of Virtue, Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban. Right now, I would like to welcome Bill Dubuis, writer, and Alex Harris, photographer. And their new book, which is actually a reissue of a 1990 book, is called River of Traps, A New Mexico Mountain Life. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Lovely to be with you. Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Now, what were the two of you, who were not New Mexicans originally, what were you doing in the early 1970s in New Mexico that led to this book?
Well, we were brought out here by the same person. We both came out here to work with Dr. Robert Coles. We were called research assistants. I, for one, didn't do any research in that first year. Got in a little bit of trouble now and then, and spent too much time in the bars in Española. But it was Coles who got us out to New Mexico, and Alex did a great job working with Coles that first year, and they produced a wonderful book called The Old Ones of New Mexico.
You know, I thought when I came out here, or Charlotte, that I was here for a year's assignment and then I would move on to something else. But you know, Bill in this book writes about the notion of the right place, and somehow New Mexico felt like, and northern New Mexico in particular, the right place for me. I rented a house. I ended up renting another home in the village that this book is actually set in. And at that point, Bill was in California. He called me up and said, I'm thinking about coming back. And I just said, well, stay with me and Bill. And at that time, his girlfriend, Ann, moved into the house.
Yeah, we told Alex that we needed a place to stay for a couple of weeks while we found a house down in Santa Fe. Well, that was 1975, and Ann and I finally found a house down in Santa Fe in 1986. So we stayed with Alex a little bit longer than we thought we were going to.
As these things happen.
But that got us all three of us, to a village called El Valle, which is near the village of Las Trampas, along the so-called high road to Taos. And it's in the heart of what you might call the deep north of New Mexico, very much in the Hispanic homeland of northern New Mexico. And we were fortunate moving into that place to soon find that our closest neighbor was a marvelous older gentleman, a farmer, former bootlegger, former sheep herder, Jacobo Romero.
And this book is really a tribute to his life and about your relationship, that you and Alex and the three of you, about your relationship with him. I think it's important just to insert here that River of Traps means Rio de las Trampas, which is the name of the river, which is Las Trampas, means the traps.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Why it's called that, nobody knows.
It's sort of a mystery.
So, Jacobo Romero, tell us about how you met him and how your relationship with him developed.
Well, as I say, he was our nearest neighbor. And early on, I guess the day I first shook his hand was a day infected with electioneering, as today is. The spring primary was coming up. It was May, I guess, or about June, and Jacobo came by to our house. He recognized that the three of us, if we all registered as Democrats, that would boost the Democratic registration of the precinct for which he was chairman by, I don't know, 20%.
Having a yeah, few dozen people in it.
That's right. So he came by to introduce a couple of worthies who were running for county clerk or running for commissioner or whatever, and also to introduce himself. And
what I remember about the way – sometimes I wonder if I remember something or I remember it because of the way Bill wrote about it. But Jacobo introduced himself to us that day by saying, and me, I'm Jacobo Romero, your vecino. your neighbor. And that word, vecino, came to mean a lot to us. We began to learn what that meant over the years as we lived in El Valle.
One of the things that's really fascinating about the book is the understanding that this man has of how to use water. So you're working up in the acequia system, you're getting water out of the acequias, and you, Bill, are trying very hard to irrigate a field and failing at it to the point where certain parts of the field are called Texas because they're so dry, and another part is called Albuquerque, whereas his fields are weirdly lush and green. And what happens when you ask him how he does it?
Well, he just tells us, let the water show you. And that was again and again his answer to those things. But there was a lot going on at multiple levels. Of course, Jacobo taught us how to irrigate. But at the same time that then we were his students in irrigating, he was also stealing the water from us at night. And in a way, that was the built-in graduation exam in our education for us to figure out that we were being consistently stolen from, and then to resolve that without any kind of confrontation.
You know, having said that, it's true that he was taking our water for a while. But I think that even when he gave us our water back, and even in the years since his death when we've had plenty of water, we've never been able to irrigate that land the way that Jacobo Romero irrigated it. And I walk through places across the river where I know he had water down below a set of cottonwood trees, and I long since have given up getting water there. So there's a way in which he was such a master. He was a virtuoso, and try as we might, I don't think we're going to get there.
Did you want to have a rural life? Did you want to farm the land? I mean, was that in your travel plans when you started this whole adventure?
To say that I had any plans would be a gross overstatement. I wanted to write a book. I was working on a book up there, which became the book Enchantment and Exploitation. But in terms of further plans than that, I think all of us were just kind of playing things day by day and seeing what happened.
And the story of that book is also an interesting one because at first it was about the land and the trails, but then it developed a human dimension very quickly.
That's right. I started out on that book thinking that I was writing a sort of glorified trail guide to the Pecos wilderness. And then, much to my dismay, I had to metaphorically follow those trails down into the villages where they originated and try to say something intelligent about those communities and the people who lived in them. And all the while, I would be working on this thing, and Jacobo would be coming by in the morning and interrupting me, and it would irritate me a little bit, but I'd spend time with Jacobo. And it was only much later that I realized all the time that this was happening, Jacobo was educating me about what I needed to know in order to write that book.
And you would later look for something in the dusty archives of the library or whatever and realize that Jacobo had already told you.
Had already told me in a very revealing way. And I had carried that knowledge into the library the way I would have a burr on my pants leg, you know, and realize, oh, well, there's a connection here.
Well, do you remember any examples of that?
Well, yeah, a big one. Part of the book is an account of the shenanigans over the Las Trompas land grant. And I followed the documentary trail through the archives and established that this person bought it and this person did that and the court did this. And meanwhile, Jacobo had told me the story of how all that was perceived by the people in the village, which had almost no connection to the legal realities that were taking place. In fact, one member of the village was viewed as someone who had helped to convey the commons of the land grant to the gringos, and in fact, he had been the leader of the charge trying to win back some land within the land grant that had been unfairly conveyed. So it was this new layer of oral history that Jacobo gave me that really made the tale most interesting.
And then you were able to incorporate that into your book.
That's right.
The conflicting stories.
Exactly, yeah.
Alex Harris, you, when you got there, well, the two of you together were looking for a house to rent or houses to rent at a certain point, and a realtor said, oh, you don't want to live in this Hispanic village. You're an Anglo. You won't be welcome there. And Bill writes very eloquently of how you just made yourself welcome there by talking to people and by establishing yourself as a friendly person. How did you do that? What was it like for you?
Well, I had an assignment that first year, which was to make photographs of the ancianos of northern New Mexico. And I think I had a personality that was oddly suited for it. Bill describes me as being, how do you put it, Bill,
quiet and withdrawn and yet friendly at the same time.
One step away from rigor mortis, one of our friends said.
So there was something about that shy person that I think people wanted to take in, wanted to take care of me. And I had a kind of a respectful fascination with the people I was meeting in the culture. And I think people can sense that. And I went and made photographs that year all over northern New Mexico, portraits for that book, The Old Ones of New Mexico.
We're talking to Alex Harris and Bill Dubuis about the book River of Traps, A New Mexico Mountain Life. So this man, Jacobo Romero, it had many children, a wife, in a way, a simple life, in a way, as you've been describing, a great deal of wisdom. One of the things that you said that I found so fascinating is that the basic value was not money or anything else. It was food.
It was food. And also, this is one of the things I think that makes the book so rich is that Alex and I had the same experience of the man who is at its center, of Jacobo. And so as we were working on the book, and it was all after Jacobo had died, it was after Jacobo died that Alex said, let's see if we can put together some kind of tribute to Jacobo. And so I began trying to write, but the things went well, not least because Alex was there to talk to. And I think we stimulated each other's memories of those times with Jacobo. And one of the ideas that Alex forwarded that became sort of central to the book is this idea of intactness. Jacobo's top value was, yeah, it was about food production, but it was also about the intactness of his farmland, the way the land looked, the processes of food production that it supported, the results of the character of the animals that it supported, et cetera. It was all one whole, and it wasn't evaluated primarily by money, it was or by proceeds. It was evaluated by this sort of intangible sense of intactness, how well all the pieces fit together.
And, you know, you asked about photography and what it was like to be a photographer. I think one of the great things for me about photography, particularly when I was a young man, but even now, is that photographs often say more than you know. And these pictures said something to me, but they said something different to the Romero family. They said something to Bill. And I think they ended up becoming a kind of a catalyst for some of Bill's writing in the book, certainly the parts of the book that are labeled as cantos, where he writes directly to the photographs. But I think at other times, I remember Bill having certain pictures up in front of his writing desk just as a way to think about who this man was, how he moved through the world, how he spoke, the clothes he wore. They were a kind of a testimony. And ultimately, connecting them to Bill's words, I think the way that we did added up to more than either of us could have hoped for.
When you say that you saw the photographs differently than the Romero family, what do you mean?
Well, let me give you an example. I remember the first time, one of the first times, I would print these pictures in my darkroom, by the way, and Jacobo would often come into the darkroom. And I'll tell you just a little aside story just to give you a sense of his personality. He was fascinated by the whole process in the darkroom. At least I was doing something. Bill was sitting in front of a typewriter, but he could see me making something.
Right.
And these pictures of Jacobo would come up in the developer, and I'd take them to the fixer, and I'd look at them, and invariably one or two would be off, and I would just throw the picture in the trash and go make another print. And Jacobo would say, oh, there goes poor Jacobo Romero. People say he was a pretty nice man, but now he's gone. And he had this – so he noticed that the pictures were being made and that he had a sense, I think, of what I was doing. But I remember showing pictures to the Romero family, and it was a photograph of Jacobo irrigating in the field. And I was interested in the way he was almost like a dancer, the way he was using the shovel and moving along the ditch. And I remember the family just looking at the picture, and then after a while they turned to each other and said, not very much rain that year. You know,
right,
you
right.
Know, they were really seeing them in another way.
Very, very practical point of view. Another thing that was so interesting that came up in the book was that there was no task that didn't ultimately involve some kind of social interaction. So if you had to hammer something or use a tool, you had to borrow the tool, and that became a conversation.
That's right. You go to your neighbors, you need, let's say, the post hole digger or something like that. Well, you can't just go to the tool shed and take the post hole digger and say, see, I'll bring it back tomorrow. You visit, you talk about how your horse is or whether the cow had the calf and is so-and-so back from Denver and all that kind of thing, so that every activity was sort of lubricated with extensive social interaction, and that slowed everything down. And the rhythm of life in that place at that time was still sort of at a horse-drawn pace.
And in fact, Jacobo Romero was somebody who didn't like engines and cars and things like that, and he, for much of his life, used horse-drawn tools.
That's right. I don't think Jacobo ever learned to drive a tractor or a car. I mean, and I would have run as hard as I could in the opposite direction if he had made the attempt. But he rode a stately, gaunt, impassive, tall, red horse until very late in life. And he was still a caballero, right, almost, well, into his 80s.
And even the interaction that he had with that horse, as you describe it, is so different from what we urban people know, where even our horses are kind of pets and we have a love relationship with them. That horse didn't like him very much, and you described it as kind of a business relationship.
That's right. It was strictly business. There was no affection exchanged. And yet when the horse died, Jacobo grieved for the horse, and he also grieved for the lost freedom of his own life.
It was ironically the death of the horse that really threw us together with Jacobo in a way that I think none of us would have imagined, but he began to pay more attention to these relatively able-bodied gringos living up the road as people who might drive him someplace he needed to go, or even help carry the tools, or sometimes to work with him. And more we became partners with him in the irrigation of his fields and the fixing of his fences, and got to know each other much better in that way.
There is such a beautiful and, I guess, poignant portrait of that era, which was the transition from a really land-based economy to a modern cash-based economy.
Yes, Jacobo and his close friend and contemporary Tranquilino Lopez of Las Trompas would talk about the quebrada. Quebrar means to break. Quebrada is the breaking. And the break between the old ways and the old days and the new ways and days. And they placed that break for that part of northern New Mexico in the period right after World War II. But the break was still happening. Jacobo and his generation grew up speaking only Spanish. They grew up really in more of a barter than a cash economy. They grew up with the values of the old times and ways. And I think both Alex and I feel just incredibly blessed to have known somebody so well from that time and that culture and that era.
He had all these children, some of whom married gringos, and that was or to use that term, whatever you want to call it. and that was a little bit of an adjustment for him. But how do you feel, I mean, when you talk about the quebrada, how do you feel about it versus how his children feel about it? Did they miss the old ways?
Well, I think his children were, you know, everyone, I think, loves his time or her time of growing up. And his children were as part of their time as any of us is of our time. And there wasn't a lot of looking back on, oh, I wish it could have been that way. I mean, especially for the women, my golly, that the workload of daily chores in the days before running water and washing machines and things like that was just so very, very difficult. I mean, the burden of labor was enormous. And so nobody's wishing to bring that back.
Right. There are some stories of brujería, witchcraft, that happen. And it also transports you. This is something I've often wondered, is whether magic realism in novels and stories is really not just realism.
Hmm. Well, it seemed to me plenty of times that things in El Valle were strange enough that you didn't have to make anything up. And the stories of the old timers about mysterious lights that danced ahead of them as they came down a long trail, or that led them out of peril on some difficult journey or whatever, were just utterly captivating. And those stories also come out of a time, a pre-electronic time, when especially on long winter evenings, the entertainment in the village was to go over to a neighbor's house and just sit down and listen to the old-timers tell stories. And they were great storytellers. Alex has photographs in the book, some series of photographs of Jacobo telling a story. And you see the hand gesture and the motility of the face as he, you know, makes the grimace of a bear or whatever. And it's really wonderful to get a sense of a true old-time storyteller.
There's a chapter in the book where Bill captures very well how Jacobo uses his ability as a storyteller to capture me as his peón for the day, his worker. We'd been trying to fix a fence at the river. Rains had come. I was in a bad mood. I didn't want to be there anyway. And we walked back to the truck that I'd driven him down there in. And I was ready to go. And I remember saying to Jacobo, "Oh, let's go. We can just do it tomorrow." And he could never think of putting off work until tomorrow. And he started telling me a story about a man who used to live there, a story of the Huerta Sales, about an old lady who was scared of dogs. And after a few minutes, I put down the idea of leaving and picked up my camera and started making his pictures. And there's one picture in that series that is in the book where it's not so much about the story. It's he looks at me and he realizes he's got me. He's got me for the day as his worker. But, you know, he had me in other ways as his friend and as his neighbor, and I had him too. And it was a friendship as much as anything else.
The book is in many ways a portrait, verbal and visual, of Jacobo Romero, but it's also so much of the two of you, and I wonder why there aren't more photographs of you guys.
If you had seen how we looked in those days.
Totally adorable, no doubt.
Nobody would have ever taken the book seriously.
No, really.
It is funny.
Well, you know, it didn't set out to be that kind of a book. It really, I simply was spending so much time with Jacobo that I thought, as long as I'm hanging out with him, I'm going to make pictures. And Bill and I were talking about this today. I didn't really have the idea of a book, but I realized at a certain point that something special was being captured in these pictures. It was a portrait of a kind of a worker we wouldn't see again, but also a portrait of an extraordinary man. And so I wasn't out there documenting Bill and me because eventually we were going to do this book about Jacobo Romero. We
right.
came on the idea of the book later.
Bill Dubuis is a writer and Alex Harris is a photographer. Their book is called River of Traps, A New Mexico Mountain Life, and they will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe in a free lecture and presentation of the photographs and the book, end of the book, which is a reissue of a book that was first printed in 1990. And meanwhile, you also, Alex Harris, will on Friday night from 5 to 7 be at the Webster Collection, which is at 54.5 Lincoln here in Santa Fe.
That's right. There's an opening of other photographs I made after knowing Jacobo, color photographs from both northern New Mexico and Cuba.
And we're not talking about Cuba, New Mexico.
That's right.
We're talking about Cuba, the country. It's great to have both of you on the air. I'm sorry we can't talk longer, but ladies and gentlemen, check out the book River of Traps, A New Mexico Mountain Life. Thanks both so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome Sarah Chase. She's a former NPR reporter. She lives and works in Kandahar, Afghanistan, and she's the author of the book, The Punishment of Virtue, Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban. And she's going to be speaking tonight at the forum at the College of Santa Fe at 7 o'clock as part of the series Rebels, Revolutionaries, and Reformers. It's a free lecture. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's wonderful to be here.
Now, first of all, how did you find yourself living in Afghanistan?
I was actually, I'm a former colleague of yours. I used to be a radio reporter, as you just mentioned, and so I was working for NPR, and I was sent to cover the fall of the Taliban. I was sent into the area, into the region, late October 2001. So I went in as a reporter and stayed throughout that, over that winter.
So a lot of our listeners and a lot of people in the United States, when they think about Afghanistan, aren't really sure what's going on there and what the power dynamics are and what the U.S. role and mission is there. Maybe you can give us sort of a brief history over the last 30 or so years.
Yeah, I mean, it's a country, you can almost think of it as like a wall that separates three really major parts of the world: the Indian subcontinent, the Iranian plateau, and the Central Asia. And this wall has basically two doors in it, and so it's a linker of empires in a way. And as a result, it's often come under a squeeze play, you know, from these neighboring countries. So what happened in the late 1970s is the Soviet Union was very anxious to extend its influence southward and basically took over the country. It took over the government and occupied militarily the country. And a lot of people have a tendency to think of Afghanistan as this tribal society that's never been governed or anything like that. That's really false. And instead, it's a country that has tribal social structures. So it's a form of social organization. But it's almost like people are sort of dual citizens. They have tribal identities at the same time as they consider themselves to be Afghans. But the thing is that when Afghanistan has come under attack, like it did by the Soviets, the country is able to dissolve its nationhood in an interesting way because people can fall back on these tribal identities, and those allow them to then fight back against an invader like the Soviet Union. And that's what happened. And we, the United States, got really involved because this was a kind of proxy way of jabbing, of bleeding the Soviet Union, as it were. So we poured a lot of money into this Afghan resistance against the Soviets, but we didn't do it directly because that would have created Cold War, you know, that would have exacerbated Cold War tensions. So what happened was we gave the money to Pakistan, and the Pakistani military then doled out our money and Saudi Arabian money also to these different resistance factions. And interestingly, it was the Pakistani military that was really thinking about using Islamist fundamentalist ideology as what, you know, Pakistan thought would be the best antidote to communism. So the bulk of our money got spent on this really extremist faction called Hizb-Islami is what it's called. Really interestingly, when the Soviets did withdraw in 1989, the Afghans didn't want to be ruled by an extremist fundamentalist government. And so the country kind of dissolved into civil war because all the other factions were determined that this guy was not going to run the country. At that time,
what did they want?
Well, I don't know because I wasn't there then. But what I can tell you is what they want today is really similar to what we want from our government, meaning they want a say in their collective destiny. They want hospitals that have doctors in them that have some kind of qualifications. They want schools for their children, boys and girls. They want teachers in those schools who have some kind of, you know, it's really interesting. They want civil administration that performs a function in a respectful and dignified fashion. And you know, but then what happened was total chaos because you had seven different factions. You had, you know, Kabul being shelled by different factions. You had Kandahar, where I live. Literally, I once asked a friend of mine, you know, oh, was so-and-so governor of Kandahar during the Mujahideen period is what that's called. And he started to laugh. He said, Sarah, yeah, he was governor in the governor's palace, and somebody else was governor two blocks away, and if you had five guys and a street corner, you were governor on your street corner. And that's how it really felt to people. And this went on for like three, four years. And by 1994, two things happened. One is the Afghans were so exhausted by this state of chaos that they were desperate for any alternative to this state of chaos. And the other thing was the Pakistani military realized that this Hizb-Islami thing was not going to work. And they ginned up an alternative. So the idea that the Taliban spontaneously evolved inside Afghanistan is also false. It was created deliberately by the Pakistani Military Intelligence Agency in 1994 and inserted into the country. But it was by that time, as I said, the Afghan population was so exhausted by the civil war that anything looked like a better option. One analogy that I like to use is cancer. The resistance leaders had also been pumped up with a lot of money and a lot of weaponry during the anti-Soviet occupation, anti-Soviet resistance during the 1980s. And you can think of them as becoming sort of cancer cells. They were no longer subject to these tribal kind of traditional democratic checks and balances in a way. They were like cancer cells. And you can think of the Taliban in that context as being like the, I don't know, like the horrible operation, you know, that this body politic had to go through in order to cut the cancer out of the body politic. Now, interestingly, after 9/11, we, the United States, needed to move quickly into Afghanistan to, you know, combat the Taliban regime and stuff like that. And we kind of took some shortcuts. And what we did was look for proxies who would be our ground troops in a way. And we thought, okay, well, who is most likely to fight against the Taliban? And we thought, oh, well, it will be the people that the Taliban kicked out. Well, the people the Taliban kicked out were those warlords, those cancer cells. So basically, to continue the analogy, we took a syringe, sucked up the cancer cells, and re-injected them into the body politic. And the deterioration in the situation from 2001 until today is really due to that initial error that we made.
It seems like the set of errors goes back in history. I mean, if just going back to the Cold War, the unintended consequences of fighting against the communist regime at that time led to this in
and,
a way.
You know, the difference is that at that time, the resistance really was a very widespread resistance. I think the mistakes were how we did it. And again, there was a kind of short-sighted tendency to buddy up with whoever could do – it was very short-sighted – whoever could do the job right now. So we said, okay, we'll pile a bunch of money into Pakistan. We don't really give a damn who Pakistan gives it to so long as they give it to somebody who's going to fight the Soviets. And then what happened was the wall fell and we got all preoccupied with Eastern Europe and stuff like that. And we just totally forgot about Afghanistan. And I think there's another really interesting contextual thing that I've thought about a lot. And it's now starting to hit home here because we've got a lot of veterans coming home with psychological injuries, with post-traumatic stress disorder and combat trauma and stuff
from
like
Iraq
that.
And Afghanistan.
Correct. Well, imagine living through a decade of violence in which a million out of 20 million civilians were killed. Imagine what that does to a society. So you're looking at an entire society that was walking around with combat trauma, and the rest of the world just sort of abandoned it. And so I think you're absolutely right that the errors do go back. And it was very frustrating to me to see when I went in as a reporter who had never been in that region before. I'd been in the Middle East quite a bit, but I had not been in South Asia. It took me about 2 weeks to figure out that there were a bunch of people we really didn't want to be working with. I mean, all I had to do was interview the Afghan refugees. We're talking October 2001, November 2001. And I would ask them, well, you know, it became obvious the Taliban regime was going to fall. And I said, well, how do you feel about this? And they would say, oh, we're so happy. We are so, you know, we'll be able to go back home. And this is a really despotic regime and all that stuff. But one thing we're worried about is that maybe the warlords will come back again. It took me, with no experience, 2 or 3 weeks to figure this out. And it's exactly what happened. I mean, it is exactly what happened. And one thing that was really interesting, I became friends with a particular tribe, a cross-border tribe. And there was a guy who kind of took me under his wing, and he became like a police precinct captain in Kandahar in the immediate, you know, after the Taliban fell. Summer of 2002, he says to me, what are we warlords still doing in government? And I said, excuse me? Could you repeat that question? He said, when I decided to join this fight, I took a solemn oath to bring an educated government into power in Afghanistan. And the Americans said that that's what they were going to do. And they told us all that we were just helping them in the war fighting part and they were going to bring educated people into the government. So what am I doing still here? And I was blown away by the question. And that guy actually resigned his position. He's the only one who did. But he said, this isn't the Afghanistan that I helped topple the Taliban to see replace them.
We're talking to former NPR reporter and author Sarah Chase, who will be at the forum at the College of Santa Fe tonight at 7 o'clock talking about Afghanistan. So you, at a certain point, decided to stay.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of things that went into that, including just a visceral love that you had of the place.
Yes, that's part of it, but I would say that it's secondary. I mean, Afghanistan is legendary for causing people to fall in love with it, and it has this mystique about it. But I actually have to say, and this is going to sound really metaphysical, but I have to say that that's not what really inspired me to stay. What inspired me to stay was I felt like 9/11 was a watershed event for this country and for the world. And I saw it almost as an event that was going to define the 21st century, the same way that the assassination of the Archduke that led to First World War defined the 20th century. And the way I saw it and still do see it is not an issue of us against the Muslim world, but almost the opposite, almost like there are people in the West and in the Muslim world who believe in that kind of a clash of civilizations ideology, that kind of let's divide the world up into irrevocably hostile blocks that, you know, necessarily have to be at each other's throats and stuff like that. And that's, we lived through a century like that. The 20th century was like that. And I don't think that was a very productive or enjoyable way to live a century. And that's not the century I want to live in this time. And I believe that civilizations are the West, is Muslim civilization, the Far East. We're in an interconnected world. And we've got a lot to learn from and teach each other. We all have our weaknesses and our strengths. And why I stayed in Afghanistan was to fight against clash of civilizations thinking, and it felt like the place to do it.
In some of the letters that you've written back over the last few years since you've been there, in one of them you said that a lot of Western Americans and Europeans ask you, well, are the Afghani people really ready for democracy?
Thanks for asking that, because it really is one of the most – that is the question that shows to – it's like – Americans live on Mars and Afghans live on Venus. I mean, it's like the discourse is so opposite. What we've experienced is the opposite of democracy. Like I said, what the Americans did, and I can understand the short-term reasoning behind it as a military tactic, but we brought these warlords back into the country, and then we installed them in positions of government, and then we backed them up. So there's no recourse for the Afghan citizens. And what I always thought American democracy was about is checks and balances, is prevention, all kinds of mechanisms to prevent the abuse of power. And instead of that, what we've done is usher people back into positions of power who are busily abusing power, and we're not calling them on it. And the Afghan population isn't in a position of enough strength because we've financed and armed and backed these warlords to this extent. The Afghan population is too vulnerable to be able to really take them on.
But it's not that they don't know what democracy
exactly. is. Exactly. It's the opposite. Their experience is that we have prevented democracy from breaking out in Afghanistan. They want it. One time I was sitting around with my cooperative members,
Cooperative, which is fascinating.
But I was sitting around with three of the guys, and I said, okay, just for fun, I said, and these are people, of the three, I think one was illiterate and two have maybe fourth, fifth, sixth grade education. So these are not, you know, highly educated people. But I said, you know, okay, we're the collective mayor of Kandahar. What job do you want? The first guy says, I want to be the garbage collector because I'm sick of seeing this rubbish, piling up on the corners and children will play in it and it's a health hazard. And on our street, for example, we privately pay this little old guy with a wheelbarrow to pick up our trash. And everyone on the street pays him $1 a month and we have a beautiful, clean street. And my guys are saying, why can't the city do this? And the next guy says, I want to be in charge of the Registry of Public Deeds because I'm sick of powerful people arrogating land or putting people into other people's houses, you know, without asking them. The third guy says, I want to be basically the FDA. I want to be the guy who goes around the bazaar and checks on the weights and measures and makes sure the meat is healthy.
Amazing.
Can you believe it?
Amazing.
And not,
because these are the things that we take for granted, but everybody wants them done and needs them done.
That's right. And so it's interesting because one of the other things I do is I provide cultural training for incoming NATO officers into the South. So like when they're doing their pre-deployment training, I'll go with a group of other civilians, you know, and we take part in these exercises and stuff like that. And sometimes it is important to understand cultural differences and as I said, you know, what the tribal dynamics are and things like that. But sometimes I think that we can overlook these basic similarities in basic aspirations that people have.
Let's talk about this cooperative that you started, the Argonne Cooperative, which people can find on the web at Argonne, ARGHAND.org. It's fascinating. You had this idea to provide an alternative to people growing poppies so they could grow other things that would then you would make value-added products out of and sell them in Western markets.
Yeah, well, it turns out it's a really, again, a kind of counterintuitive thing. If I could describe for you the landscape, actually it's kind of similar to Santa Fe, only more so. There's less, you will never see a freestanding tree in Kandahar that somebody doesn't irrigate. You can't, you know, there's no vegetation. The place looks like the moon. But it's also a fruit basket. This is a place that was exporting grapes to Babylon during the Sumerian Empire. And so it turns out, you know, people talk about alternative crops and stuff like that. And I say, to poppy. And I say, you've got them all here. They've got pomegranates. It is the pomegranate capital of the world. They've got these incredible grapes. They've got almonds. They've got apricots. The issue is now internationally, you know, Babylon didn't have phytosanitary requirements, right? You can't export fresh fruit to the United States or Europe without these incredibly stringent health, you know, requirements. Plus, logistically, fruit is heavy and perishable. So what I was thinking is, you know, it's not – I don't directly work with poppy farmers and tell them plant roses instead of poppy. But what I'm trying to do is expand the market for licit local agriculture by buying it up to turn it into other things than just foodstuff. So what I thought about was this incredible appetite we now have for natural skincare products. And so you turn over a natural bar of soap that, you know, and you look and there's sweet almond oil and there's apricot kernel oil and there's all this stuff. And all of that stuff grows in southern Afghanistan. So we designed a line of soaps around traditional products or traditional agricultural products that exist down there, and then even found new stuff. We found this flower. We went, you know, walking up in the hills, a place where you can't go anymore because of the Taliban, but a couple of years back I could. And this incredible flower that smelled like almost like a piña colada. It smelled like bananas and lime somehow. And, you know, then it would be this voyage of discovery. I'd have to look the thing up and find out what it is and make sure it's not poison and all that stuff. It turns out to be a relative of sage. And so, you know, now we are contract farming that flower with a couple of farmers up in the hills where we basically guarantee to buy all of their all of the blossoms that they can give us. And this is something that grew wild. So no, it never even had a market before. And we have roses. We've got people growing roses for us. We've got three or four types of herb that also grow wild.
And you ordered a press from Germany to extract the oils from
exactly.
It, which is a great story.
That's right. We and, you know, I didn't know. I was really groping my way. I mean, I don't have a manufacturing background like that, or chemistry or anything like that.
But the creativity that you and your friends and associates put into this, I mean, these you started to make these soaps and, you know, getting the shape of them, and you decide to hand mold them so they look like these beautiful marble stones.
Yeah,
and these are what's marketed in these beautiful stores here in Boston and all sorts of places in the United States.
Exactly. And it was also really interesting because at first, you know, Afghans have this feeling that modern modernity means industrial production. So the first comments that I kept getting in the beginning were, oh, don't you have a mold? And my answer was, well, we're actually sick of soap that comes out of a mold. And you know, and again, marble is a local, they've got beautiful stone there. So again, I was trying to kind of play up the local aspect of things, and it just got so, as you put it, really aesthetic. And now everyone, it's men and women in the cooperative, and everyone loves it. I mean, they're now saying, oh wow, the desert fields came out really well this time and stuff like that. And so so that's been interesting also to see how you can take something that is traditional, like these agricultural products, but it did take me to bridge the kind of aesthetic, because Afghans wouldn't have really understood modern American
aesthetic. What American
aesthetic.
Ladies might want in their bathrooms.
Exactly.
And meanwhile, you're doing this homegrown small business that is the kind of thing that we talk about when we talk about microcredit loans in other countries or whatever. And then you're working with aid agencies that are trying to fund big, huge projects, and they've got their SUVs and their air conditioning and all of this stuff. And the contrast between what you're doing and what these aid agencies are trying to do is really stark.
It was incredibly frustrating. I mean, we are looking at opium is a $4 billion industry in Afghanistan, and we are spending a lot of money digging up people's poppies in their fields. Now, these are people who are structurally bound into the opium economy because, for example, I wonder how many people listening to us right now don't have a credit card. Well, guess what? Afghans need credit too, but they don't have credit cards. They don't have banks. And you mentioned microcredit, but microcredit is usually only given to businesses. How many people listening to us right now, or you or me, only use our credit cards for a business expenditure? Well, no, Afghans need to add a room onto their house. They need to marry off their kids. That costs a lot of money. You know, they need to borrow money. There's no credit available, so they borrow money from the opium trafficker. The opium trafficker won't take money back. He wants opium back. So they have to plant opium. Now, this isn't everyone, but it's a large number of people who are planting opium. And there are other structural reasons why they get into it, too. And our only answer to this is to, like, dig up the poppy in the field.
Instead of what you're doing, which makes a lot more sense, which is providing an alternative.
Exactly. And so it was very – there was USAID, which is our overseas development agency – gave $119 million over a five-year period to this private contractor for alternative livelihoods, which is exactly what we're doing. I can't begin to tell you the nightmare of trying to extract any of their money out of them.
I've read the narrative, and it's unbelievable.
It is.
It's so patronizing.
It's patronizing. It was needlessly painful. I mean, needlessly.
They had you doing 99-page spreadsheet business plans, which no Afghan person is going to do.
Exactly. And which they then turned around and told me they didn't need in the first place.
Right.
I mean, it was – and it got to the point where we did get one grant from them, and we sailed through it with flying colors. We finished all of our benchmarks ahead of time and all this stuff. Not to mention that it is – I mean, I don't want to toot our horn, but – I've been really moved by how inspiring it's been to people in the West. I mean, the community that we have built among our retailers, we've got volunteer warehousers,
You provided people, as you say, with an opportunity to help.
Get involved.
To get involved.
And it got to the point where it was so humiliating, as you put it, it was so patronizing that the second round, they put us through such painful loops. One time they came and visited when I wasn't there, and they grilled the cooperative members so much that the cooperative members told me afterwards they felt like they were in a police interrogation. And we just all decided, we sat down and I said, you know, I want to give up this money. I want to not go for this. And my cooperative members said, you know what, we shouldn't kiss anybody's hand for money. And they felt like they were being demeaned. And I thought, no wonder, you know, opium is runaway. If we are not a little bit more imaginative in figuring out solutions that allow farmers and their families to stay alive. And I would say that we've had slightly better luck with the Canadian version of USAID. So we do currently enjoy a grant from CETA. We're about to put in an entire solar electric system because we only get a couple of hours of electricity every couple of days. And when you mentioned this seed oil press that we got from Germany, the first version was a hand crank model, you know, and so we were spending hours. I felt like charging people, like, you know, because we were going to be like a health club.
Yeah, right,
you know?
Exactly.
And we graduated to an electric version, but it's 3 kilowatts of electricity, so we actually need to have some electricity. We only have it once every couple of days, so thanks to the Canadians, we're going to be able to put solar energy in and hopefully be able to expand.
Sarah Chase is a former NPR reporter. She lives and works in Kandahar, Afghanistan. She's the author of the book, The Punishment of Virtue, Inside Afghanistan After the Taliban. She'll be at the forum at the College of Santa Fe tonight as part of the Beyond the Lecture series over there. And her website is sarahchase.net. That is SARAHCHAYES.net. And you can also find her these products at the website argand.org, ARGHAND.org. Sarah Chase, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz presents an hour of songs from the Great Depression, but hopefully not to depress you. Broadcasting from the studios of KSFR, we will see you tomorrow. Robert Knott will be here and much, much more. Hasta la vista. Ciao.